Welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to the most important segment of society, to those who know that the world's political, religious, military, and economic institutions are corrupt, and that they are counterproductive, and they cannot be fixed. Our phone number, if you'd like to participate in this discussion, is toll-free, 877-376-45. I've listened now for a number of days, maybe weeks, to the ad that plays in the middle of the SRN news about the fate of Christians in North Korea. And I kind of scratched my head. The reality is that North Korea is one of the few remaining communist countries. Yes, I know politically that China is communist, but it isn't economically. And the difference between a totalitarian government in one place versus another, you know, is it fascist, is it communist, it really doesn't make much difference. And almost all countries are becoming police-slash-military states. So really the only thing that's interesting to look at is how free is the economy. And the economy is highly controlled, highly centralized, with no personal incentives in North Korea. And as a result of that, the North Koreans are incapable of growing sufficient food, of distributing sufficient food, of making anything that they can sell on world markets to buy sufficient food. It's the nature of economics. Without personal incentive, there is no motivation for people to do anything. And that's the reason why communist and socialistic economic systems fail. It's why free enterprise as an economic system prevails, but it takes a very sophisticated individual to appreciate its nuances, and it's easily attacked and therefore maligned around the world. But that's the problem in North Korea, is the centrally controlled economic system, which is great for empowering individuals, but lousy for the masses. I don't know what you would do with an organization that's trying to deal with the Christians. I'm sure that in North Korea, since there have been millions who have starved over the last 50 years, and even those who aren't starving are hungry. The only ones that really eat meaningfully well in North Korea are either directly associated with the police, the army, or the government. And outside of that, you know, you're lucky if you get enough to eat to make it to the next day. And I can certainly see why Christians, if they're overt about their religion, if that is what defines them, would be those who would be the most ostracized, the last, if you will, to be fed. No, it doesn't make any sense to me to be a Christian. It does make a lot of sense to be opposed to that government, but it's pretty hard for one individual to overthrow it. But then again, how in the world are you going to feed or take care of people in a totally closed society? So I don't understand what the charity is trying to accomplish, but I did think it was reasonable to let people know that the Christians in North Korea are not children of God. They are only brothers and sisters religiously if you're also duped into being a Christian. And I doubt that there is much that anyone can do to resolve their fate. There was a 55-page report that came out today, published by the Australian Transportation Safety Board, that outlined how investigators have narrowed down the possible final resting place amongst thousands of possible routes of the Malaysian jetliner that disappeared, some 100 days ago. And, you know, it's not becoming to say I told you so. So I won't say I told you so, but I do recall saying several times that it was apparent that the problem in that with that flight is that they had a rapid decompression of the cockpit, and that they all fell asleep. And the review of what has occurred says that the pilots and crew were unresponsive due to hypoxia, and that the final period of that jetliner's flight was carried out entirely on autopilot. There was no one at the controls. But that was the obvious conclusion, is that they had a breach of the cabin pressure vessel, and hypoxia is what caused the problem. Also, under the guise of I told you so, the San Francisco Asiana airliner that crashed, most of the articles said killing three people, wounding 182 others. Actually, the crash only killed two. The San Francisco Fire Department killed one, running over a young girl with her fire truck. The issue there was exactly as I had shared with you. The flight crew was unable to land the airplane by hand. They were capable of doing is exercising the autopilot. So when there wasn't an ILS instrument landing system available at San Francisco, it had been out of order for quite some time. They were incapable of flying the proper intercept or glide slope. That they also disconnected the auto throttles, they did not maintain the proper airspeed. They were at one time too high, at other times too low, sometimes too fast, sometimes too slow. That they were unable to establish and maintain an approach on glide path, on speed. And it's sad in that the one thing that we all train as pilots is to land planes by hand on bright sunny days, which it was in San Francisco. No one should have had any issue whatsoever landing any aircraft. We're all very accustomed to the clues and the way the airplane feels, the way things look before us, and scanning our instruments. And they simply got the airplane too slow, too low, and crashed it. It is a wholly pilot error that caused that 777 to crash. In bigger news, Reuters is reporting that militants, this would be ISIS, and ISIS now, boy, I don't even know if ISIS is the right term for these folks, because they're really a complete blend of ISIS, which is the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, of the Ba'ath Party and Sunni operatives within Saddam Hussein's government. They are members, former members of the Iraq military under Saddam Hussein, and also Sunni warlords, the tribal chiefdoms throughout Iraq, the Sunni tribal chiefdoms, as well as Sunni professionals of one ilk or another. And so it's a full mix of a lot of different individuals. Just to label them ISIS, I think, is a disservice to our understanding, but they haven't claimed any other names, so it's hard to know what else to call them. But they are in the process of taking their country back. And today in Iraq, they were demonstrating the modern version of Blitzkrieg, and they were they literally took over a town every hour from the communities surrounding Baghdad. They were particularly adept at capturing natural gas fields The overnight offensive included Jabal, which is home to major gas fields where foreign companies operate. The security forces said the fighting threatens to rupture the country's after two and a half years after the end of the U.S. occupation. Well, the U.S. occupation ruptured the country, and it was just only a matter of time before we ended up in this mess. It was inevitable. It was eminently predictable. This continues to call the ISIS assemblage of desperate parts, insurgents, led by hardline, I don't know what hardline means, but let's call them fundamentalist Islamic State in Iraq. And they, Reuters wants to use Levant, even though Levant is not used in the name of the terrorist organization. And it says it's now also including many other Sunni groups. They are blaming Prime Minister Maliki for marginalizing their sect during the 8 years in power. And he is, now, what's interesting here is that people have been dumbed down. And they've been dumbed down for a very long time. And it's very difficult to motivate people to fight for an ideal. But it is easy to get them to fight if you say that Hiroshima is, Emperor Hiro is a jerk. You could say Adolf Hitler is a bad guy. We've got to go after Adolf Hitler. America rallied troops to say Saddam Hussein was a bad man, so we need to go and get Saddam Hussein. Mullah Omar, bad guy. We need to go fight to get Mullah Omar. Osama bin Laden, bad guy. We need to go fight to get Osama bin Laden. Maliki is being used the same way. If Maliki wasn't there and it was any other Shiite prime minister, he'd be attacked exactly the same way. If they replace prime ministers in Iraq next week, the following week, ISIS will be blaming whoever it is that replaces Maliki. It's just the way that people are motivated when they're not asked to think. Iraq's secondary, number two, Shiite religious leader, Muqtada al-Sattar, who controls the Mahdi Mujahideen, the Mahdi in Shiite Islam, is the it would be the their version of the kind of the Jewish religious equivalent of the Messiah. And I have to say the Jewish religious equivalent of HaMashiach, because in rabbinic Judaism the Mashiach is just a man having no connection of any kind with the divine. Simply a man, because in Messianic, not Messianic, but in Rabbinic Judaism, God is incorporeal, which means that God is not only spirit, but he is incapable of taking physical form. And the view in Rabbinic Judaism is that the Mashiach will be a warlord. He will be a fierce general who will rally Israelites to victory, is the view that the rabbinical community has of the HaMashiach. It's the reason why Rabbi Akiba, around 133 CE in the Yovel year, was able to beguile a significant number of religious Jews into believing that Bar Kokhba, who was a warlord, was their Mashiach. So that's the view. In Islam, the Mahdi is also a religious leader, but with warlike tendencies, and his ability to lead a unified Islamic assault against the world, and therefore establish Islam as the lone religion in the world, is the definition of their Mahdi. What's interesting, of course, is that you have to take this with a grain of salt, because the Mahdi is only part of Shiite Islam. The invention was probably 700 years after Muhammad's death, and Shiite Muslims only represent 15 to 20% of Muslims worldwide. So it's not like it is a pervasive aspect of Islam. But the Mahdi Mujahideen is the largest of the Shiite militias in Iraq, somewhere between 50,000 and 100,000 strong. That's Muqtada al-Sattar. He was also the Islamic cleric that was the most vicious to Americans when Americans were initially fighting in Iraq and would go down city streets and fight from town to town. It was the al-Sattar's Mahdi Mujahideen that imposed the greatest casualties on America. You know, that's why it's such a laugh when American leaders like Paul Bremer talks about using the Iraqi army to eradicate al-Qaeda in Iraq. There was no al-Qaeda in Iraq, but there were huge and very well-armed Shiite militias. And the Shiite Iraqi army did not fight the Shiite militias. The Shiite militias fought and prevailed mightily against the U.S. They were originally or ultimately shut down by Sattar at the request of al-Sistani. And the reason was al-Sistani went to Sattar and said, you know, we could continue to go play Mujahideen and Jihadist, and we could take out a lot of Americans, but why would we want to do that? By us throwing out Bremer's constitution and us having one person, one vote for a constitutional Congress so we can elect all Shia Muslims to write the constitution. And then when we have the constitution, since we outnumber the Sunnis almost 2-1, we'll control the government, since the American plan gives the government to us as Shia religious leaders, since the American invasion took out all of the Sunni infrastructure, the Sunni government officials and the Sunni police officials and the Sunni army officials. The only power left was the Shiite clerics. And so America's plan gave them Iraq. And so Grand Ayatollah al-Sistani went to Muqtada al-Sattar and says, let's just chill for a while. We chill for a while, the Americans will leave, and they're going to leave us with the country. It's ours. You know, we can deal with the Sunnis once they're gone. And that's exactly what has transpired. And it was obvious while it was occurring. We'll be back in a moment. So as we continue with this Reuters article that came out today that is announcing that ISIS and friends are overtaking one town an hour in the suburbs of Baghdad. Iraq's Shiite religious cleric, Muqtada al-Sattar, a foe of Malakis, called for all Iraqis to deplore the Sunni insurgency and rally behind the army, but said that a new government was needed with faces from all spectrums and away from sectarian quotas. Yeah, right. You know, this is just hilarious, the way these guys are positioning themselves. A Shiite religious cleric views all Sunnis as infidels worthy of death. A Sunni religious cleric views all Shiites as infidels worthy of death. They hate one another more than they hate Jews. And by the way, it's one of the interesting things about Islam is that it's not just that Muslims from the two opposing sects of Islam, and you know, 99.5% of Muslims fall under the two sects, Sunni or Shia. There's also Sufi Islam, but it represents half of 1%. Among Sunnis in particular, but even also among Shias, there is enormous animosity. And if you look at Syria, for example, you have fundamentalist Muslims that are part of the Victory Front, al-Nusra, and then you have fundamentalist Muslims that are part of ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. Well, both are fighting the Assad regime and Hezbollah. Both are also fighting each other. It is the nature of Islam. You know, for the years of the Ottoman Empire, was Sunni Muslim, and they went to war against Saudi Arabia and took control of Mecca and Medina and much of Saudi Arabia. So it just to lay the landscape out here, when the Sadr speaks, first of all, those beguiled by Islam of the Sunni or Shia persuasion, they just believe him. And they say, okay, the Sunnis are terrorists, but what we need is a government with faces from all spectrums. You know, one way you could get away with these sectarian quotas is just to have an entirely Shiite government, which is, by the way, what they have now. The head of the army, a Shiite militia which fought U.S. troops in Baghdad, Sattar vowed in a speech on Wednesday night to shake the ground under the feet of ignorance and radicalism, just as we did under the feet of the occupier. So, the occupier, of course, was the United States. And so, Sattar is taking credit, A, for the Mahdi Mujahideen, the Mahdi army, but also for the terror that he inflicted upon the U.S. Invaders. And now he is speaking of ignorance when it's used in Islam, because you have to be stupid to be a Muslim. So ignorance has a very special connotation in Islam. To make what is the dumbest religious doctrine ever conceived. And that's saying a lot, because, I mean, you've got Scientology out there and you've got Mormonism out there that whose basis is just fundamentally stupid. And yet, Islam is dumber still. When you read the Quran and you hear its scientific gaffes, its historical gaffes, its internal contradictions, its never-ending childish arguments, the number of things that it says that are just blatantly untrue, to my mind, it is the dumbest mainstream religion ever conceived. So for that religion to call other people ignorant, the purpose of that was that Muhammad, who was dumb as a stone, wanted Muslims to believe that while they may not be the sharpest tools of the shed, the Arabs, prior to Islam, were dumber still. Now, there's no indication that's true, but it's always called the time of ignorance is the time before Islam in Arabia. And so that's the idea that Muslims are better informed and more knowledgeable and wiser than Arabs were before they were forced to become Muslims. Then the same approach is taken to the non-Islamic world. So if you are not a Muslim, you are deemed part of the ignorant. Because if you were enlightened, you'd be a Muslim. That's the mindset. So here's the dumbest religion in the world, calling those who don't agree to be stupefied by the dumbest religion in the world ignorant. Then it goes one step further, which is that as a Muslim, if you're a Sunni Muslim, then the Shia Muslims are unenlightened. They are ignorant because they haven't chosen the right path. And likewise, if you're on the other side. So by using ignorance and radicalism, now you can't be any more radical or fundamentalist than Sattar. He's simply saying that his Mahdi Mujahideen is going to terrorize the likes of ISIS and the Baathists the same way that they attacked Americans, that they're putting Sunni Muslims in exactly the same position. The concept I'm looking for here is that when a nation wants its soldiers or its citizens, they're demonizing them. They want them to feel no compulsion about going off and killing an enemy. They demonize them. And so what Sadr is doing here is he's demonizing Sunni Muslims. So it's really laughable when in the previous breath he says, oh, there should be no sectarian quotas, new faces, we should reach out to everyone. And his next breath, he's using Islamic terminology to demonize Sunni Muslims, saying that his Shias are going to shake the ground underneath them, just as we did the occupiers. Meanwhile, in northern Iraq's largest city, Mosul, as we know, fell to the Sunnis on June 10th. There's only one town, one city thus far, that ISIS has taken that they were unable to hold. It's Tikrit, which was Saddam Hussein's hometown. It's a town which is a fairly significant player in oil extraction and distribution. And there it's the Kurdish forces, not the Iranian army, the Iraqi army, which is really the Iranian army, that has forced them out. So the Kurds are a formidable force. Now, army airstrikes today were designed to hit Mosul, and they did. They killed one person, they wounded six others, and those they killed and wounded were simply civilians. I mean, all they're doing is making people mad. The Sunni fighters, and you can't just call them ISIS anymore, as you know, want to form an Islamic caliphate from the Mediterranean Sea to Iran. They wish to take over Iran. That would be their ultimate goal. And then take over all of everything from including Israel, but also Jordan and Lebanon and Syria, including Iraq, and call that their emirate, of which they will establish a caliphate. And that won't be the end of it. From there, they'll strive to take over the rest of the world. They now control the border between Syria and Iraq, and this article acknowledges what we've been saying for some time, that they are very well equipped because they were originally given U.S. weapons in Syria to fight Assad, and now in Iraq, they have stolen billions of dollars worth of U.S. weaponry. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, who's been a busy boy because he's traveling around the world, lashing out at everyone like the entire world belongs to the United States of America, pressed the Iraqi officials to form an inclusive government during a visit this week and urged leaders of the autonomous Kurdish regions to stand with Baghdad against the onslaught. Yeah. It's hard to imagine that he's really that stupid. I mean, I know that's the rhetoric of Obama, and he's paid by Obama, and so therefore paid by the U.S. taxpayers, but hired by Obama. Here you have the two dominant Shiite leaders, and they're calling the Sunnis ignorant, which means they're infidels, and they want to terrorize them. And you have the Sunnis viewing the Shia as a lesser life form, wanting to obliterate them. And you have the Kurds who despise both and who just want to be left alone and for the first time to have an autonomous region that is theirs. There is no chance whatsoever, not in a thousand lifetimes, that this is going to be resolved by everybody getting together. Getting them together is what caused the problem. If America actually wanted to do something that would be productive in Iraq, what we should be saying is, let's divide Iraq into three countries. A Kurdistan in the northeast, a Sunniistan in the northwest, and throughout really the western part of the country from top to bottom. And in the southeast, it'll be literally annexed into Iran as Shiistan. So if the Americans' rhetoric was going to be productive, the things that you would do is to pull the military advisors out, stop selling spare parts and supplying weapons to Iraq to make the killings more egregious, and allow them to divide that country into three parts. While they wouldn't get along, at least there wouldn't be civil war. There wouldn't be tens of thousands of people dying. And there wouldn't be such grotesque loss of coin and blood. We'll return to Shattering This after the commercial break. Continuing with this article by Reuters that is assessing the events of today in really the most war-torn region in the world. It reads that Malaki's Shiite-led State of Law coalition won the most seats in the April election but needs support from other Shia groups to build a government. There is only one law in Islam, and it doesn't matter if you're a Sunni or a Shia Muslim. The only law in Islam is Sharia. So Malaki's political party is called the State of Sharia. Tells you a lot, doesn't it? This is not a secular political party. The political party is State of Sharia. And how do you resolve a conflict when the most successful political party is called State of Sharia? Now, the United Nations has said that more than 1,000 people, mainly civilians, have been killed during the Sunni insurgents' advance in Iraq, which is a pretty minor number considering the territory they've taken over. And that figure includes unarmed government troops machine gunned in mass graves by insurgents, as well as several reported incidences of prisoners killed. In addition to the bloodshed, close to 1 million people have been displaced in Iraq this year. So it is now being called the land of displacement. Yesterday I was covered most of an article about what was taking place in the communities around Mosul, particularly in the one remaining enclave for Assyrian Christians. Well, they've all been put under Sharia law. They've all been told that any unmarried girl must serve as a jihad slave, a sex slave, to the Muslim Mujahideen. All other women have been told that they should only go outside if absolutely necessary and under Sharia, which means they have to go outside accompanied by a male. And that when they go outside, only when necessary and only when accompanied, which means they can't go outside to go to school, which means they can't go outside to buy groceries. They can only go outside when absolutely necessary and when accompanied by a male, that they have to wear the full burqa. They can't be seen. They've also said that all shrines, monuments, and graveyards, as well as churches, which are all seen as idolatrous amongst the Salafi Muslims, will be destroyed. Now, when the jihadists arrived in the Syrian city of Raqqa, and this is the same group, so they're using this as a comparison, which they now completely control, residents thought that life was better for a while. Then they took over the two churches, they tore down the crosses on the churches, and they turned the churches into jihadi recruiting stations. Today, the remaining Christians are made up of Assyrians and Syriacs, Armenians and Arabs practicing variants of Orthodox and Catholic Christianity. Many worshiping in otherwise almost extinct languages such as Aramaic, and this says the language of Christ or Assyrian itself. You know, it's sickening, really, how pervasive lies can be. You know, even when you read the so-called Christian New Testament, when Paul wanted to speak to a large assemblage of people, it says specifically that he spoke in Hebrew. That when he wanted the people to listen and understand what he was saying, that he had to speak in Hebrew. When Yosha is actually cited saying that he spoke in a particular language, the reference is always Hebrew. There's only one reference to Aramaic, and it doesn't say that he spoke in Aramaic. It just happens to now contain an Aramaic phrase. You know, my God, why have you forsaken me? And the difference between Aramaic in Hebrew as it relates to Azab and to El, God, insignificant. And it, when you look at the evidence, and now you also have the advantage of the Qumran scrolls, where there were countless letters circulated amongst various individuals, we know now for certain that the populace of Yisrael in the first century CE spoke and read Hebrew. Yahusha spoke Hebrew.